From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 40 years, Dr. Stuart Mushlin's diagnoses have ranged from the mundane to the mind-blowing. When he is stumped, he turns into a detective, kind of like an episode of the popular medical drama House. He focuses on his patients, who are scared and worried about their lives. This hour on Point, a doctor opens his most complicated case files. You can join us on air or online. Are you a walking, talking medical mystery? What's that like? Tell us your story. Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from Tampa, Florida, Dr. Stuart Mushlin, an internist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston here. He's also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's the author of the new book, Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Mushlin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here, Jane. Thank you.
So this book outlines 20 medical mysteries that you've encountered over the course of your four-decade-long career as a physician and a professor. What did you want to accomplish with this book?
A couple of things. One, medicine's fascinating. And though a lot of what a doctor does in their daily life is pretty routine, no patient comes in with a warning sign, a sandwich sign on their front and back that says, I'm a mystery. Good luck, doc. So I wanted to share some of the very interesting cases that I saw and had trouble figuring out and sometimes stumbled on the answer. So I wanted people to hear that these things present to an internist's office. I wanted them to see how doctors approach problems. It's not a perfect science that we always kind of hone in immediately on the right answer. And I wanted people to see the imperfections of the way doctors think and the way they work. And most importantly, I wanted people to share in the experience that I've had the privilege of sharing of patients who are stricken with an illness, who have to be resilient, who have to have hope, and who have to be determined to get better and be empowered by the doctor.
You think about medical mysteries and you think about, you know, popular TV shows like House MD, and you think about doctors drilling down and, you know, putting their detective hat on and, you know, sort of going to work. Is that an accurate portrayal of how your work unfolds as a physician trying to solve really complex, complicated medical problems?
Well, I think it's 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. When you're confronted with a medical dilemma in terms of a diagnosis, sometimes it just comes to you. Other times you'll talk to a colleague and get a good idea. And other time you have to go to the literature. So I think, you know, to compress it into a 48-minute kind of TV episode is a bit artificial. And certainly I think a lot of the doctors on TV are better looking than I am and also smarter. But certainly a chunk of what you see on TV is true. And the appeal of these cases is true.
So give us an example, in a nutshell, of the cases you write about in the book. Give us a snapshot of one that you find most compelling.
So the case I personally wrote about that I like the best is a case of a heart attack that was due to stress. And I'm not happy about the fact that this happened to this lovely woman, but it came out of the fact that she was so much in love with her husband, who had just had a heart attack the same day. And it highlighted to me the role of love and interaction of a couple with a positive marriage and guilt. And the notion that that we underappreciate that stress can cause a great deal of physical bodily harm. So to me, that case where a husband had a classic heart attack and then about 11 hours later, his wife, who was very much brooding over his heart attack, she also had a heart attack, highlighted for me a lot of the mysteries of what goes on in medicine.
You talk about solving mysteries, and you do write about a lot in the book, treating families and the influence of a spouse in office visits and in diagnoses.
Oh, sure. Lots of times I'm stumped. I don't know what's going on. The patient has told me the story, and I bring them back, and they tell me the story again, and I'm still totally puzzled. Often the key to getting the right answer is to bring the spouse in the room, sometimes alone, sometimes with the patient. And very often the spouse's take or interpretation of what's going on unlocks the mystery.
You came to medicine, Dr. Mushlin, with an unconventional background, an English degree of all things. Is there anything about studying the classics and composition that made you a better doctor, that helped you with patient care, especially solving these medical mysteries?
Well, I don't know if it made me better, but it certainly gave me an appreciation of humanity. When you study English or comp lit as an undergraduate, you see the whole kaleidoscope of human behaviors presented in novels and in plays and in poetry. And you talk about them in seminars and in class. And when I became a physician, kind of around the time I was truly in training, postgraduate training, I realized that this stuff that I was reading about and was a little distant from was happening to me as a practicing physician. So I think it gives you a tremendous amount of insight. It's awe-inspiring to realize that people have written about the human condition, you know, since we've got recorded documents. But a doctor can literally every day see this stuff parade through their office.
You talk about the ability to understand themes and meta-themes, both for the patient and for families, and the cultural anthropology of the patient's life, that your training in that area turned out to be more important, actually, than all that math, all that complicated math that you took.
Well, this is my belief. And in fact, medical school admissions have started to morph so that undergraduates are now encouraged to take sociology and anthropology and cultural anthropology, as well as the hardcore sciences mm-hmm. like math and chemistry and physics. But in my daily work as a clinician, internal medicine doctor, I use those English language communication skills, those cultural anthropological skills, much more than I ever used linear algebra and matrices, you know, which I did take as an undergraduate. And yes, you think about metaphors a lot if you have this background, you know, concretely. That heartache might literally be a figurative heartache. It's not angina, it's that child with opioid addiction who's, you know, stolen from your home yet again and who's flunked out of rehab, you know, five times. And when that patient comes into your office with chest pain, you have to be able to go kind of macro and micro and say, is this a metaphor that they're expressing, or is it truly they need a major cardiac workup?
In your medical practice and now in your role as a teacher at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, is there a type of patient, Dr. Mushlin, that is more susceptible to being a medical mystery than another?
I don't think so. I think You're a very unlucky person if you're a medical mystery. Fascinating to read about, you know, interesting to your doctors as they try and divine what's really going on. But for you, the patient, it's not good. You're sick. No one seems to know what's going on. One of the chapters in the book, I talk about a woman who really most of her doctors, some of whom I was acquainted with and were very, very fine physicians, really thought she was psychologically disturbed and didn't have a true medical illness, an organic, what we call an organic illness. And so it's bad to be a medical mystery. You better to have a cold than something I write about in the book.
Do patients ever resent you for solving their mysteries? I'm thinking about the patient who sought medical treatment for knee pain and ended up finding out he had leprosy, right? Leprosy diagnosis, yeah.
I, Sure, people can resent their physician, and that's a failure of communication on the physician's part. You know, we're humans, and patients react to your human persona as anyone in kind of regular life does. That gentleman, I was trying to illustrate my foolishness as a doctor, so proud of himself having finally, after really over a year and a half, made the diagnosis. And in my self-congratulatory hubris, I kind of, you know, forgot the fact that this guy didn't want this diagnosis at all. And then indeed the treatment changed the color of his skin, and he had fevers from the treatment, and he was miserable. And, you know, I was kind of immature and telling him, oh, you'll get better, and isn't it great we finally know what you have. And he probably did the right thing and went to a wiser doctor.
There's real heart in this book and in your efforts. It's not just a book about the ailments that you diagnose, that you discover. It's really about the patients who are so often scared and worried about their future and, you know, your own vulnerability. You're very honest. You don't always get it right. But you say in the book, you're not just treating disease, you're treating people.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in medicine, we use a lot of shorthand. This is a case about X, this is a case about Y, and when I'm teaching the students, I say, no, this is a case about Ms. So-and-so, who's ill with this. And I think as doctors who are surrounded by illness, we have to remind ourselves that first, they're human beings.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about medical mysteries and what it takes to solve them with a medical detective, a longtime medical doctor. And you can join the conversation. Doctors, what do you do when you're stumped? Are the answers in more tests, more listening to the patient? Here's season one of Fox's House MD. A boy comes into the hospital with unexplained bleeding. This is a scene in House. Where House, actually played by Hugh Laurie, and his team of doctors brainstorm about what could possibly be wrong.
Kid's going to be dead in a matter of days if we don't figure out why his red blood cells are disintegrating. So, differential diagnosis, people.
Well, it's not environmental. Dad hired a company to clean the house, maid washed all the clothes, bought hypoallergenic sheets and pillows.
You want us to recheck?
No. If it's environmental, he'll get better just from staying here.
It could be an infection.
No fever, no white count.
Well, he's 99.2.
Barely above normal.
But above. His body's reacting to something.
We could account for the lack of fever and white count if it's lupus.
Drugs will fit just as much as lupus. Meth will cause hemolytic anemia.
A lot of meth.
My guest this hour, Dr. Stuart Mushlin, internist at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and author of the new book, Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. What's the cost of a medical mystery, doctor, like the ones you spent your career solving? And how does insurance factor into a complicated diagnosis?
Yeah, the cost is usually high because when doctors don't know, they gather data. And that kind of wool gathering is expensive. And of course, the system is not at all transparent. So the doctor often doesn't know how much sending out that arcane test, you know, to Mayo Clinic, where they're the only place in the country that runs it, how much that's going to cost. So fortunately, in Massachusetts, I think it's 99% of people now have health insurance and are covered. But
that's not the way it is everywhere, right?
Right, and I think it might change soon in the country also. So it's expensive to be a medical mystery, and the more doctors don't understand your condition, the more they tend to generate a lot of data. It's our personality is such that we like to measure things, we like metrics, and the more we're puzzled, the more we like to measure this and measure that, and of course sometimes you get so much data that it's hard hard to see the forest for the trees.
So, but in the age of the 15-minute office visit, if you get that with your doctor, how do you draw back to the time-honored techniques of observing and touching and listening to patients that seem to be so undervalued today?
Well, you've touched a nerve because I'm an old-time guy, and this is how I was taught. There's a saying in medicine that everybody stands on the shoulders of giants who learn something, and I had wonderful teachers both in medical school and in my postgraduate training at the Peter Van Brigham Hospital, and to a man and woman, they taught me that the right thing to do was to listen to the patient and examine the patient and take as much time as is needed to diagnose the patient and to comfort the patient.
But what do you say to doctors who feel that pressure to diagnose quickly because they've got insurance restrictions and, you know, a waiting room full of patients?
Yeah, well, it's a problem, and I think that they need to always monitor their own behaviors to make sure that they're doing the best that they can for their patient. We all have friends who say, you know, I saw my new primary care doctor, and I got the sense that her hand was always on the doorknob. You know, she was writing in the computer the whole time I was there, and her hand was always on the doorknob. Stuart, what should I do about this? And I say, change. Go somewhere else.
Give us another example, doctor, of the medical mystery that really touched you. I'm thinking actually specifically of the patient with the bilateral carotid body tumors who'd been dismissed by a lot of doctors.
Yeah. So this wonderful woman illustrates a number of things. So first of all, she had a very unusual condition, and I didn't recognize it because I had been kind of exposed to it only in the dog lab in my physiology course in the first year of medical school. And I just kind of – that wasn't high on in the front of my brain to think about. But she had had a tumor of her right carotid, and then some years later developed very labile blood pressure and did very poorly in dark rooms, needed sun, had a lot of anhedonia, a lot of just kind of depression type symptoms and lack of interest in life and family and the job that she had enjoyed for many years, and palpitations. And she came to my office through a physician friend who said, you might try this guy, meaning me. And she had seen a number of very good doctors, both in suburban Boston and at some of the major medical centers in Boston. I knew some of those doctors. And she came to interview me. And I appreciated the fact that she was up front about saying, you know, I'm here to see whether, one, you can diagnose me, and two, whether I want you to diagnose me. And I always appreciated that. When patients came to interview me, I never resented that, and I never charged them for that visit because I think establishing a doctor-patient relationship early on is a good thing. And if the relationship is never going to work, better to know that right up front rather than when the patient becomes unwell, has no confidence in you, and then is really distressed. So she came to interview me, and while she was interviewing me and describing her symptoms, she became very unwell. She looked dreadful. She said, I'm having an attack right now. I guarantee you, she told me, my blood pressure is extremely elevated. I'm having severe palpitations, and this room is too dark. Can we go somewhere where there's more bright lighting? And I thought, sure. So we left my consulting room and went into an exam room that had a lot of very bright lights and actually had a light that was movable for when we needed to remove stitches or things and needed a portable bright light. And she said, please leave me alone for about 15 minutes and I'll be better. So because she looked so unwell, I took her blood pressure, and indeed it was very high, very abnormally high. And I was reluctant to leave her. And I told her, I said, your blood pressure is really high, and if it doesn't come down pretty quickly, you know, I want to wheel you down to the emergency room. She said, oh, no, that's the last thing you should do. That would be dreadful. Just leave me in this brightly lit room for about 10 or 15 minutes and come back. And so I did with some trepidation because I was worried she might have a stroke or something dreadful would happen.
And the malpractice and suit to boot.
Well, yeah, there's there's
all right,
always
go on,
that.
Go on, go on. Right. We'll talk about that later.
So I came back and her blood pressure for this very slender, thoughtful woman was indeed low now. It was down by over 100 points. Her pulse was nice and low. Mm. I asked her, did you take any medication? Did you do anything while I was out of the room? She said, no. I just sat here in the bright light and relaxed, and it went away. And she said, this is what happens to me. So I was fascinated and had never seen anyone like her in my practicing lifetime.
And so what was the mystery? How did you solve it?
Well, I thought she had something called a pheochromocytoma, which is, you know, really a $20 word for a tumor of the adrenal gland that secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine. When she agreed to become my patient and she thought that I would be okay as her physician, I got her records, and many doctors had had the exact same thought and had worked her up on more than one occasion and very thoroughly. For that, and she clearly did not have that. Mm. So anyhow, the way I solved the mystery was one day, you know, it just kind of popped into my head, a picture of me in the dog lab squeezing a dog's internal carotid artery with a blood pressure monitor in one of their arteries and remembering that, oh, yeah, this woman told me she had had a carotid body tumor. Well, that shouldn't do this, but it sure sounds like maybe she's had a recurrence. So she didn't have a recurrence. But what she had was another tumor on the other side. Mm. And that was really disinhibiting her entire blood pressure regulatory control. And that was the answer. Yeah. And it was just kind of a flashback to my first year in medical school. And truly, I had been percolating her situation kind of in my subconscious for a number of weeks.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book, how your subconscious brain seemed to be always engaged with a patient's problem, like even waking you up early in the morning with ideas or solutions.
Well, that's happened to me since college, and it mostly happened to me. I liked math. In spite of being an English major, I kind of liked math, and I had a modest facility for math. So what happened is I took these advanced math courses, and I had a friend who lived down the hall from me who was a math and physics major, and he was really gifted in math. My wife knows his story very well. His name is Benedict Feinberg, and he's a physicist. And I would try and do these math problem sets, and sometimes I wouldn't get the answer. I might get, you know, two-thirds of the problem set. And I'd go to bed, and the answer would be in my head when I woke up the next morning. But of course, my friend, who's a math and physics major, that never happened to him because he would just look at the problem and see the answer. In any event, that started to happen to me a lot in college, is that I realized my brain works on things kind of in silent CPU mode while I'm sleeping or thinking about something else.
Luckily for your patients. That's such a great story, Dr. Mushlin. Let me get a call in here. Yep. Jay is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Hi, Dr. Mushlin. Good morning.
Hi.
My situation is unfortunately very complicated, but I've learned to boil it down quite sort of quickly. 10 years or so ago, I was in the beaches of South Florida in the Gulf area, received some bites from some insects, I guess, on my shoulders of some sort. And within a few weeks or a few months or so, these bites seemed to get extremely infected. Well, as weeks and days and months went on, I was preparing to enter into a career in the health sciences field with some kind of therapy for, you know, for myself, I mean, for me to be a therapist. Mm-hmm, and they just seemed to kind of keep growing, a few here, a few there. But they began to be characterized by when they would break open these lesions or pimples with a foul smell and unusual material within the lesions. And so I did have a positive diagnosis for MRSA, but then a couple years later, the same places labbed a negative for MRSA. Then about a year ago, they labbed positive for general staphylococcus. What's very bizarre about these places, sometimes in the last couple of years, they went from pimples, doctor, to sort of a flat ulcerated lesion about the size of a dime. Mm. And these they'll just kind of open up on either my forearms or my shoulders. And a few of these lesions, doctor, have appeared bilateral, meaning to say on the acromion process of each shoulder, I've had the exact same lesion, the exact same smell, the exact same thing. And then also on my forearm, on my left forearm.
So, Jay, let me interrupt just for time's sake. I mean, how has it been like for you dealing with this issue for many years as a certifiable medical mystery? You could have been in
right.
Dr. Mushlin's book for sure.
Right.
How does this change your life?
Well, for approximately 12 years as this has went on, I've lost income. I was going to be a neuromuscular, a medical massage therapist with mm-hmm. excellent grades, excellent character. I've lost close to $700,000, $800,000. I haven't dated. My teeth are beginning to crack and to age unusually. Mm. My hair is falling out at a faster rate. And, at the last point real quick here, at the center
yep.
or the deep in the lesion, I'm finding a entity about an inch long that looks like and feels like a worm of some sort, and that's a very common, kind of like a thick, but the size of a match. And,
Jay, thank you. I'm going to jump in here because I have to say I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. So, Dr. Mushlin, I mean, we could go on with a diagnosis here. Can't diagnose over the radio, but, you know, you hear the traumatic years right. of trying to figure this out, right?
Right. This is a patient's lament. I'm no better. I've seen people and no better. I want to give the caller hope. I think this is solvable. There are many, many things that can cause these kinds of skin lesions. We call it a differential diagnosis. It just means all the possibilities that are. But for a dermatologist or an infectious disease specialist, either one of them, if he were able to access them when he had a couple of lesions, they would, with a high likelihood, be able to help him and diagnose it. It's not impossible that these are infectious. It's not impossible that these are primary dermatologic conditions. It's not impossible this is a manifestation of some other systemic illness. But I do believe he can be helped and get an answer and with luck, be totally fixed.
Jay, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Mushlin, how does geography and economics, for that matter, factor into your work as a medical detective? I mean, you spent time in Western Massachusetts. What are the differences in smaller rural hospitals versus the big flagships like we have here in Boston?
Yeah, so I've been spoiled. I spent the last 18, 19 years in a major teaching hospital in a great city for medicine, Boston, and there's just a tremendous critical mass of gifted physicians. I'm not talking about myself. I mean, mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. capable people who don't just have mastered their discipline, but are big thinkers. And so they're all over the place. The problem in more rural areas is there are many, many gifted doctors, some of whom have chosen to work there because that's their home where they mm-hmm. came from. Others who like the lifestyle, but the critical mass is sometimes not the same. And the resources of some very small rural facilities is sometimes certainly not the same as at a big academic teaching center.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about medical mysteries and those baffling cases that leave even the most experienced doctors searching for answers. You can join the conversation. Who solved your medical mystery? Television shows like the Discovery Channel's Mystery Diagnosis focus on people with obscure medical ailments who struggle to find out what's causing the symptoms. In this episode, Holly Pushevsky and her husband Mike lament her intense leg pain and wonder if it's due to her fertility drugs.
On a scale of 1 to 10, this was a 15.
And we just took a giant step backwards.
We didn't have any answers. We didn't know what was causing the pain. We didn't know why I couldn't get pregnant. And I thought, are my hopes of having a child really hopeless?
We are speaking this hour with Dr. Stuart Mushlin, author of the new book, Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. I'd like to bring in now from Princeton, Illinois, Annette Schnabel, president and CEO of Perry Memorial Hospital in Princeton, Illinois. It's about halfway between Chicago and Davenport, Iowa. Annette, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the challenges of a complicated diagnosis like the ones that Dr. Mushlin has been describing in a rural hospital, a small hospital that may not have the resources or the technology or the access that a bigger hospital would.
Well, I think that, you know, starting out with the idea that the conditions are rare. So when you think about the exposure that our providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera, may have to such a condition, it's very likely that they've not been exposed to that in our setting. However, our physicians also are trained in academic centers, so they have opportunity maybe in their past to have been exposed to things. But when you're talking about your rare medical mystery, it's less likely to have occurred because of our population density.
But so you do have more chronic illnesses, do you not, in rural populations?
Yes, we do. Actually, so the challenge is when you look at rural health care versus urban health care is that we do have more chronic conditions. We have more patients that are dependent on the government payer sources, and there's other health conditions that tend to be more problematic in a rural area. When you look at the number of smoking situations, that of course leads to other conditions. Mm-hmm. So in the rural area, we tend to have more chronic conditions versus the rare because mm-hmm. we're in a small population area.
How difficult is it to place doctors in rural hospitals, and how does that affect patients? Because I know so many rural hospitals are closing, right?
That is true. It is very difficult to obtain physicians that have an interest in working in a rural area. Dr. Mushlin mentioned in the last segment that they either tend to have come from a rural area or there's something about the lifestyle, and that's what we do to attract. But when you look at the numbers, the patient to primary care physician ratio in a rural area is about 39.8 physicians per every 100,000 people, where in an urban area that's about 53.3 physicians per 100,000 people. So we have less physicians available to our patients than they do in the urban setting.
You hear a lot about the promise of telemedicine in rural areas, but I'm thinking about complex problems and the medical mysteries that we're discussing today. That may not lend itself to that sort of technology.
So with telemedicine, you know, that is something that's certainly a future opportunity for us. I think that might be less something for a rare medical mystery than other than maybe we get a consultation that leads to being able to get the patient into another level of service. So that's one thing that we would love to expand more with telemedicine to make more of that available to our rural communities. It's a challenge still, though, because not all payers pay for telemedicine. Mm-hmm. So even if we were to able to get the connections in place, we may not be able to get access to a provider.
Speaking of insurance, the debate in Washington continues about what to do with the Affordable Care Act. As you hear about the real possibility of repealing and replacing Obamacare, tell us what that would do to Perry Memorial Hospital, where you are.
Sure. So that's obviously a concern for us because I mentioned earlier that we have a higher Medicare and Medicaid population based on we have an older population in the rural area. We also have a lower income population in the rural area, so that makes more people dependent on those two programs. So as I look at the ACA and the potential repeal of it, there's potential impact on our residents having coverage. And then even with the ACA and the exchanges, we had less options available to our residents than they did in the urban areas because not as many of the plans were available in the rural area. So there's positives and negatives. We need to look at what did the ACA bring an opportunity. So we have more people insured currently. Mm. And if they repealed, then what will that do as far as access for our patients?
Dr. Annette Schnabel, joining us from Princeton, Illinois, President and CEO of Perry Memorial Hospital. Thank you so much, Annette. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. Michelin, what do you hear in Annette as far as what we're talking about here today and really solving complicated medical mysteries?
Well, I think everything she said is 100% true at every level. In rural communities where there's kind of less mobility of the population, there's also tends to be more chronic disease. In the past, prior to the Accountable Care Act, there was less access to care due to mostly economic issues. There are many fine healthcare providers, both doctors, nurses, ancillary healthcare personnel in these rural communities, but there are also barriers to getting your patient, say, seen by someone who's had more experience with the strange and bizarre. Mm-hmm. Sometimes folks in rural hospitals don't have someone they can call at the University of Chicago Medical Center or at the Mayo Clinic or, you know, you name it, and say, you know, hey, how are you, Jill? I've got a remember me, you know, I'm out here in rural Illinois and I've got a patient who I hope you can help me with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an awful lot of medical care is doctor to doctor interaction and
collaboration,
trust,
right?
And exactly, yeah. Collaboration. And so one of the things that folks in very rural areas suffer from is that lack of ability to collaborate with some folks who have access to other people to collaborate with. You know, the areas tend to be a little isolated, right, and insular.
Let's get Jenny in here from Martinsburg, West Virginia. Hi, Jenny. You're on the air with Dr. Stuart Michelin. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Bud, for your time. I have a 32-year-old daughter who, when she was 12 years old, was the first, the youngest patient of her age to have her gallbladder removed. And I tell you that because this has been the beginning of our journey through a medical care hell. Up until this point, we've not really found a doctor that can give us that big picture. We've been to specialists. We've been to some of the bigger facilities. And now I have to say that we're at the point with her resources, her financial, and having to work, that she no longer can go to the big facilities, take time off to work. She has a continuing white count that gets higher and higher, that the oncologists disagree with what the internal medicine doctors say. She was in the hospital 3 times since the beginning of the year, has lung scarring, no one can explain it. And I just think that there's 2 things going to happen here. Number one, I think she's going to have to declare bankruptcy. And number two, and I tell you this, I've been a reporter for 30 years. When my daughter, who can no longer function and is having trouble getting out of bed to take care of her two little boys, when she tells me she's afraid she's going to die, I believe her.
Jenny, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Mushlin.
Yeah, again, this illustrates the frustration that patients who are sick and basically undiagnosed as to why experience, the economic cost, both in terms of the number of physicians they see and the cost to them missing work, unable to perform at work, and so sometimes being let go from work, wanting to have the basics that we all want, the ability to live comfortably, to raise a family, to not be kind of dragged down by the ball and chain of a chronic illness and further compromised by the fact that it's undiagnosed. This does sound like a medical mystery in the sense that I just wonder why she needed to have her gallbladder removed at such an early age. What was there about her gallbladder or bile in the gallbladder that kind of gave her some premature difficulties? That may be a clue. And then there are some systemic illnesses that affect the biliary tree, meaning the bile ducts as well as the gallbladder and into the little bile areas of the liver. There are some systemic illnesses that can cause elevations in white counts and premature need for a gallbladder removal. So
she needs to come and see you. It's hard though, right? I'm going to get another call in here from Michelle in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. And Dr. Mushlin, thanks so much for your approach of really listening to the patients and comforting patients, taking time. I think that's so often overlooked. And I was really interested in what you were saying about considering all the factors when you're diagnosing a patient, taking a macro view, consulting colleagues, literature, spouses, looking at sociological factors. And I'm just wondering, if you ever partner with patients in asking them to try to be intuitive about their own bodies and try to get their sense, in an intuitive way in what we sometimes call complementary or alternative or holistic, what do you think about that? And also, do you think the tides are turning at all? Are more doctors and physicians going to be kind of taking your approach of taking that holistic view and really listening and taking time with patients?
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Dr. Mushlin.
Yeah, so one of my first questions to someone who I don't immediately kind of know what's going on is I'll say to them, what do you think is going on? I mean, it's absolutely fundamental. The patient can often just tell you what their problem is. And so I ask that all the time. Now I might not, if we both are kind of on the same page and it's pretty clear what's going on. But if I am a little, uncertain as to what the patient's symptoms, really are representing, I'll just say, Mr. So-and-so, what do you think is going on? Mm-hmm. And I would say 90% of the time they're right. They know. In terms of my approach, well, the good news and the bad news is I teach a lot. The occasional resident and student will say thank you at the end of their time with me. I appreciate your approach. Some will even say I'll try and incorporate it in my workaday life as I go forward, as I did with a person I talk about in the book who taught me a lot about how to be a doctor and how to be a manager, which is a lot of what doctors have to be. I don't mean a business manager, but a manager of their patients' well-being. And I don't call this a holistic approach. I just call this being a human being, listening to that person in your office who has a problem.
Michelle, thanks so much for the call. Just a couple of minutes left here, Dr. Mushlin. Tell us the story of the Haitian voodoo practitioner outside the coronary care unit at your hospital.
Yeah, so this was my first exposure. I was a medical intern, and there was a fellow who ran the coronary care unit at our hospital, who was a very big thinker. He helped develop the cardiac defibrillator, but he just thought out of the box a lot of the time. And he was interested in what he called, this is his label, voodoo death. How could it be that somebody by sticking pins in a doll could make someone else hurt? I'm this, you know, very green intern dealing with the simple management, because back in the day, that's all we had available was simple management of routine heart attacks. And in one of these rooms was a Haitian person, and there was a voodoo man who looked pretty strange and bizarre in the room. And this Dr. Lown would tell us, I'm now going to tell the voodoo doctor to be threatening to this gentleman. The gentleman was afraid that he had done something, and the voodoo man was going to talk to him about the consequences. And he said, watch the cardiac monitor. And the voodoo doctor would then talk to the man. These are Haitian gentlemen. And sure enough, you would see a cardiac arrhythmia on the cardiac monitor, and then a malignant cardiac arrhythmia that required immediate intervention to stop. So just from that very visual experience, it impressed upon me as a busy intern trying to learn, you know, how to learn the basics that, you know, there's more to this than just managing the potassium and making sure that the blood cultures are done and the right antibiotic is chosen. There's something else going on here that I wasn't taught anything about in medical school. And so that stimulated my kind of longstanding interest in this. Then I'd also mention I have a wonderful colleague named Dr. Martin Samuels, and he is very interested in kind of being scared to death. And I heard him talk on it, and that stimulated me even more. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stuart Mushland, for being with us today. I'm the daughter of a vascular surgeon who felt never more fulfilled than helping someone who is really sick. So I appreciate what you do in your life of service, and thanks so much for talking about it with us today.
Oh, thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Stuart Mushland, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, internist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, author of the new book Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.